Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Ventham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. Well, it's that time again, you lucky listeners. Actually, I can probably make this bit a bit more epic. Let's get some synth bass in here. Drop the voice by a couple of semitones. All right, try this on for size.
And now, coming to you from the undisputed heart of Sussex, it's your favorite, Ordinary Apologetics.
Ordinary Apologetics.
Apologetics for the ordinary.
Yeah, too much. So this week we're talking about the resurrection. Paul wrote, "And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain, and your faith is in vain." Everything hangs on what happened over those few days in Jerusalem around AD 33. So let's have a look at the facts and see what explanation fits best.
Hi, I'm Mark Ventham.
Hello, my name is Graham Nichols.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary.
So today on Ordinary, we're going to be doing one of our apologetic specials. And you may have been listening to a number of the recent podcasts and noticed we've had a number of special guests from around the world. Well, today it's just the Ordinary Three, and our special guest... The Three Musketeers, and Josh is back. He's no longer sitting, he's been sitting on the chaise lounge
in the room. The Three Musketeers always confused me, because there was four, wasn't there, basically? Well, I could never work out why they called it the Three Musketeers when there were four.
No idea, can't help you.
There was four, there's three plus another one.
Three plus one?
Yeah, there was, but who wasn't one of the three, but he was kind of part of the gang, really. Honestly, and do research on Three Musketeers.
Well, if someone of the listeners could email in with the answer of why Graham's big concern, it's been anxious for him for a number of years now.
Hey, I've got a question.
Yeah.
Have you, either of you, heard the new Apologetics, Ordinary Apologetics jingle I did?
Yeah.
Okay, I reckon you haven't, have you, Mark?
No.
He doesn't look like he has.
No.
Oh, you're so disloyal.
I got a lot of messages about that.
I know.
People really enjoyed it. So,
what does it
say? It was your slightly contrived, what's this button here do?
Yeah, did you like that?
And then the jingle came on. It was very, very old school radio studio.
Yeah, I was in a weird mood and I just decided to go for it. But I think
people... Oh, no, I'm going to have to go and listen to it. I generally don't listen to the podcast.
So what I've done is...
Hashtag awkward.
I know you don't, but I've made a jingle especially for Ordinary Apologetics. Okay. That's how important it is.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what is... the Apologetics podcast today all about? Probably quite an important one, I would have said.
Yeah.
Is there red mist and red lines? And I love all that kind of stuff.
Red shift.
And yeah, it's talking about kind of things, woo, out there. Or today, it's just...
Red shift it was something you said in the last one, which I really enjoyed. I've used that a few times. Red shift it.
Red shift it.
That's good.
Yeah, got to do that. Yeah.
A little bit of red shift it. Yeah. But today we're not talking about red shift it. We're talking about the resurrection. So, when we're talking with our mates, at the end of the day, the truth is Christianity falls or stands on this issue of the resurrection. So, how am I going to help my friends talk about it, or how am I going to talk about it with my friends more precisely?
Yeah, it's interesting because some people might think the resurrection's more of just a normal Bible thing, whereas the other ones are kind of scientific-y stuff. But I think it does fall in the category of apologetics because it's about presenting the evidence for a monumental proposition, which is to do with Jesus being God's son, dies, rises again, on which the whole kind of Christian faith hangs. So it's out there with apologetic-y stuff, and it's in the area of evidence. It's probably just worth saying for all of these that we've been doing, it's about demolishing people's obstacles to the Christian faith and providing evidence. We never talk in terms of proof. Here's the proof. I think proof requires kind of immediate life experience of something. But we live most of our lives based on evidence. What's a reasonable explanation of the facts, the eyewitness accounts, the evidence that you've been presented with? What's a reasonable explanation? So we work on the basis of both evidence and then interpreting that evidence with all we know of the world into deciding what we think is the truth of the matter.
Is this an example?
And of course, well, I mean, suppose even historical examples that if someone comes home with, one of our children come home with a bloodied nose or a grazed knee or something, and they have an explanation of what happened, they fell over in the playground, and they have someone else who says, oh yeah, I saw what happened, then you put together the facts of kind of what you can see, but also what kind of eyewitness accounts, and you say, okay, a reasonable explanation is they fell over in the playground, there wasn't an alien who came down and landed and took a slice off their knee. That sounds really gruesome, doesn't it? But so yeah, we're doing that all the time. We didn't actually experience them falling over in the playground.
Proof
we didn't,
would have been,
we didn't see it ourselves.
If I'd actually seen it myself,
yeah.
Evidence is hearing it from another account, from others who are trustworthy.
Yeah, yeah. The grazed knee one was also that there's some sort of evidence in terms of what's happening as a consequence.
Yeah.
Which will help us to do with the resurrection as well. So we got people who are telling us, like, you know, our child's friends in the playground or the teacher or something, and we've got the evidence of the child there. That still doesn't absolutely prove what happened, but it's so compelling to put all the facts together. And then we say, well, the most reasonable explanation that has the best
explanatory power.
Explanatory power.
There's a big word for this.
Is
two big words.
They fell over in the playground and cut their face, grazed their knee. That all makes sense. And we wouldn't question that. We're doing that all the time, I think, with lots of other things, you know, a lot of experience of life. We do that with lots of historical facts that we believe based on accounts, sometimes, you know, newspaper reports, first-hand accounts of something that happened in history, some written journal of somebody, but also with kind of what happened perhaps in the country. So some big event happened. Like the existence of Hitler, you know, none of us lived through that. Even I'm not that old. So none of us lived through that. So how do we base it on, well, films that were made of him, evidence of some people who did live through it, but also kind of what happened in the whole of Europe and graves and everything else. So there's loads of bits of evidence we fit together to say it's very reasonable to think Hitler existed, the German regime existed, there was a war. We don't really question that. No one says, well, I didn't actually experience it, so I'm not sure it existed. We just say it happened. And so that's what we need to think about when it comes to the resurrection.
And we will have to think about that, because there will be alternative explanations to the one that we want to give. And so part of the discipline of apologetics and philosophy in general is this idea that Graham's talking about, which might be sometimes called inference to the best explanation. So we want to talk about these different explanations, alternative theories, but ultimately we want to weigh them up fairly and say, which one is the best? Which one has the most explanatory power and scope and is least contrived? And so that's what we'll do when we weigh up these different theories.
When you say explanatory scope, what do you mean?
To explain the whole range of evidence that's in front of us, so that it doesn't just explain the empty tomb, but doesn't explain any of the other
evidence. The best explanation of all the events, of all the situation and the circumstances, hence.
And I think as we keep underlining, this is an ordinary podcast and we want ordinary people to feel confident to talk about this. I think feeling confident about this is in a way straightforward. If you're a Christian who's going to a church where the Bible's taught, you probably are fairly confident about some of the main facts of the resurrection. But I think there's another level of confidence, which is confident to express them, but also confident that this is really important. And so finding ways with our mates of not just saying, do you realize there's proof of the resurrection, but also trying to think about the significance. So if we have time, we'll talk about that a little bit at the end when we've got through the evidence part.
Okay.
So how are we going to approach it? Essentially, I think we're going to talk about there being three rather uncontroversial facts that need an explanation, and those three facts will be the death and burial of Jesus, the death by Roman execution, crucifixion, and his burial in a tomb. And we even know the name of the person who buried him, right? Joseph of Arimathea.
Yeah.
So that's the first fact. The empty tomb is the second fact, uncontroversial. There was an empty tomb. And the third fact being the disciples' sudden and sincere belief that Jesus had been raised from the dead. That happened. Whether or not he did is not involved in that as a fact. So the fact is they believed it. So we need to explain that.
Why would we not have a fourth fact there of Jesus' appearance?
Yes, we will. Yes, that will be built into the disciples' belief.
Okay.
That they believe because they in fact saw him. So that
I
would
think
be built
the,
into that.
The thing is, the Jesus' appearance is not evidence in a sense. It's the thing behind the evidence that we get.
It's the thing we're trying to prove.
So you can't, So you can't put the resurrected Jesus as evidence for the resurrection. In a sense, you can say the evidence is the disciples were so changed by seeing the resurrected Jesus. Then that's the evidence. Mm-hmm. That's the evidence that we've got. It's their changed lives and eyewitness accounts that are the proof. So it's a bit of a funny distinction, but yeah, I think it's correct.
Yeah. So we can start with the death and burial. I think that. There's not too much to say on this because it is so well attested and so well agreed to. Jesus was a real historical character. He was tried under Pontius Pilate. He was executed by Roman crucifixion and he was buried. This is our first fact. And
And it's worth saying the expertise of the Roman army mm-hmm. would have meant that he was crucified properly. And that, as we know, there was, you might not know, but as you can show from the eyewitness accounts, there was an actual test that he was dead. There was the soldiers going and checking because they were surprised he died quite so quickly. And there was the piercing with the side and the water and blood coming out, showing that the body had started to decompose. There's all the experience of the soldiers that know the difference between a swooning person, you know, someone who's faking it, maybe to somehow think they might get off, and an actual real dead person. They'd seen so many dead people. They weren't like you and I who could easily be kind of deceived by it. He was dead. There's the kind of circumstantial evidence that anyone who had endured that amount of flogging, deprivation, suffocation on the cross would be dead anyway. So, around about that time. So there's no real contrary evidence that would say, no, he didn't really die. Mm. You know, he was just taking a nap or something. Mm. There is a swoon theory, which was, you know, he just sort of went into a low state of consciousness for a while, but wasn't really dead. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't make any sense of the facts, particularly the piercing with the sword, but especially the experience of the soldiers.
That's right. So let's have a quick discussion about that swoon theory. So that's going to be one of our alternative theories that tries to explain these facts. Okay.
Yeah.
So what that theory is saying, like Graham said, is that actually, no, he didn't die and he came to in the tomb, somehow moved the stone, somehow passed the Roman guards, and then appeared to the disciples and to the others who saw him. And that's the explanation for the empty tomb. That's the explanation for why the disciples believed he'd risen, because he didn't actually die. Now, there are problems with that already, like Graham has said, to do with the fact that the Romans are expert executioners, and this seems to be very unlikely. But also, I think a quite an interesting piece is the idea that the disciples would have been rather unconvinced of a risen, glorious Jesus if they had seen a man who was half dead, covered in blood, needing medical attention immediately. Mm. That wouldn't have been a very powerful experience for them. They wouldn't have walked around saying he's risen. They'd have walked around saying he didn't die. He's come too.
Yeah.
It would seem that is not a very powerful explanation to explain why they would then be so convinced that he had actually risen from the dead.
Mm. No, and we forget as well, he was whipped before he was put on the cross.
Yes.
He could barely carry the cross or walk to the place of execution because of the whipping that would have just absolutely scourged his back. So,
and there was a big old audience as well.
Absolutely. So this around, wasn't. This was. There's really no doubt that he died on that cross, in a sense. Yeah. And I think the swoon theory is just, it's just not plausible, is it really? No. In the scheme of all that is known of the Romans, the way they executed, actually what it would have meant if a centurion had allowed him to be taken off the cross, not quite dead, you know, you're playing with your own life. So
yeah,
it's just it doesn't work. It doesn't fit the explanatory scope.
Right, doesn't, and it's not powerful. Yep.
With you. With second me? Fact.
So he's definitely dead.
He's definitely dead. Okay.
And he's definitely buried, and we've got not just the eyewitnesses of the men, but we're told the women who are, in those terms, wouldn't have been credible, so you would only put it in there if it was actually what happened. They'd seen it. They watched him die. They stood at a distance. They followed. They saw where he was buried and where he was placed.
Yeah.
Because some... Yeah.
And the burial's also part of the convincing proof that he's dead, in that, you know, if there's any last remnant of any possible recovery theory, then actually... being carried, all the people who are involved in the whole carrying process and the women who witnessed it, realizing he was dead, the fact that you're placed in a tomb where you're not going to receive any emergency medical attention, you're just going to be in a cold, dark place. So it sort of puts the final nail in the coffin of he was definitely dead.
Mm-hmm. Except they didn't have coffins.
Well, indeed, it was a metaphor that had good connections.
Okay,
maybe so, not my best, but it was up there.
So the apparent death theory, we're quite happy to say that doesn't seem to really make sense.
No.
Let's talk about the empty tomb. So one of the explanations that we might get around that is that the body was stolen, moved by the disciples, maybe moved by Joseph, maybe moved by the Jewish authorities.
How do we know there was an empty tomb, by the way?
Well,
is that what you were going to ask?
No, but you can go.
Well, we know. Well, it's part of the case that's going to explain the sudden and sincere belief that there's an empty tomb. If there's no empty tomb, Christianity never gets off the ground.
Yeah.
It's also worth saying that this historical reliability of the account of the empty tomb is well attested in terms of historically. So we have accounts of it in the New Testament in multiple different books, which from a historical point of view is very strong.
Yeah.
I don't know if you had anything else to add there, Graham.
Only to say, that is true. Mm-hmm. And that the empty tomb is a key part of the evidence because a number of people saw it and... it would have been an easy thing to contradict if you were either the Roman or the Jewish authorities.
Yes.
Because you could go back and say, no, here it is, here's the body. So not only is it attested by the eyewitnesses, it was also not contradicted by people who could have contradicted it.
Absolutely. So the Jews could have stomped out Christianity very quickly by showing Jesus'
stomped
body.
Stomped out or stamped out, do you think?
Stomped and stamped. They could stumped it all down.
They could have stumped it
they
as
could
well.
Have stumped on it.
Okay, well, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
But so we give Jews, they would have just pulled out the body. The Romans, unlikely to want to steal the body. No need
no point.
To.
Yep.
No point. And again, would have just fessed up.
Well, there's the stealing theory. I suppose we've got to land the fact that it was definitely an empty tomb. So we landed that one. So then you got the theories as to what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, and my favourite one is that the women went to the wrong tomb.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's the car park theory. It's the, you know, you're on Waitrose, Sainsbury's or somewhere and you go back to the wrong car park.
Yeah,
you go to the wrong car.
So you went to the wrong tomb.
And everybody subsequently made the same mistake.
Yeah, so actually Jesus'
they're
body's
so
still
stupid,
somewhere.
Those people, aren't they? They just couldn't find that tomb where the person they'd loved and followed for all their lives, you know, for all of his public ministry had...
I just don't think... I mean, just realistically, if this was a dear friend, you know where they're buried. Mm-hmm. You know,
it was a new tomb. It was distinctive.
It's not like it wasn't even like his cemeteries where we are, where you've got suddenly rows and rows and rows and rows and rows. You know, this would have been a distinctive private kind of tomb. So I think they know where it went.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're saying that, you know, it's clear that they didn't go to the wrong tomb.
Yeah.
It's clear that the Jews didn't take the body. It's clear that the Romans didn't. So could the disciples have stolen the body and moved it? Well,
that's probably the best one.
It's maybe the best one, but there's lots of issues with it, which are to do with, first and foremost, the fact that they would have to have got through the guards, moved the stone, and moved the body. Maybe that's possible. But the next problem is...
You don't get the impression, though, do you?
I don't think so.
These guys are that good. They're not part of a SWAT team, Navy SEALs, to be able to get... And it's not like we're just talking two Roman guards. We're talking a whole legion, isn't it? Like, so 16 guys would have been around this tomb... that they've got to work through, distract, move a stone that takes at least two of them.
Yeah.
in order to get the body, get out, replace the tomb back, and make sure the soldiers think nothing's happened.
Yes, it seems unreasonable. Yeah. I think also a point that we will bring up later is the idea that the disciples weren't actually expecting a resurrection. So it's not as though they thought, right, it's the third day here, we need to make sure this happens, so let's go move the body so that it looks like it happened. They weren't expecting that to happen. They weren't expecting him to get crucified. That wasn't the Jewish conception of a Messiah in the first place. Right, and then the final, I think, counterpoint which undermines this stolen body theory is that, again, the disciples go to incredible lengths to defend the idea that Jesus was resurrected. They are killed for it. And so you have to then say, if you want to hold to the stolen body theory, that they stole the body, knew Jesus was dead, continued to preach that he was alive, and were willing to die for it.
Yeah, and it's a bit like a murder case, really. You need to have motive, don't you? And what would be their motive for pretending Jesus had died? It doesn't make any sense, because there's no financial benefit.
No.
It's not like they're getting ransom money for, you know, having the body or something. So there's no financial benefit. There's no sort of political or sort of status benefit. They don't, you know, become crowned local leader or king or something. So there's nothing like that. I can't see there's any emotional benefit. So you're thinking, well, what possible motive would there be? Because they didn't know they were going to start a movement. And anyway, the movement they started led mostly to them being persecuted and everything else. It didn't lead to any power for them.
Although, interestingly, I think the comeback often on that one is, well, yeah, but look at some of the cults. So you think of Waco in Texas, or Waco in Texas, yeah. Whereby, you know, a whole cult killed themselves.
Yes.
Based on what they believed to be true.
Yes.
But in fact, it was
a
lie.
Yeah, but you always get people around those things that have... The reason we know about it and we know it's not true is because you always get people spilling out of those that tell the truth about what's actually happening. So you do get a few people who are committed to a lie, but it's on a different scale. And you think about the Waco thing. Actually, you could see, oh, okay, this guy had power over loads of people and had a sort of messiah complex himself.
Right.
There's an explanation of why it happened, and there's people around who are debunking it.
Mm. But I think the big difference in those situations is those in those cults still believe it's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas the disciples are not just, hey, we believe in truth. What we're saying is they would have been deceiving themselves because they know it's a lie.
Yes.
And they're not going to die.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas those in Waco, yeah, they know, they yes. don't know it's not a lie. They that's believe true. It's true and they're prepared to die for it.
Correct.
We know it's not right. But the disciples, that's the distinctive, I think. You know, often, just they know it was the truth. It'd be weird you would die if you...
So we've got to do the third one because we're nearly going to run out of time.
Yes, so I think...
Well, we're moving there.
Yeah, we're happy. So we've got Jesus' death and burial. We've got the empty tomb. And now we've got the sudden and sincere belief of the disciples that Jesus had risen from the dead.
Yeah.
Part of the, like you were talking about earlier, part of the reason that they come to believe that is because of their experiences of seeing the risen Christ. And so one of the counter arguments to this will be the hallucination idea that these guys, they were seeing visions. So let's talk about that. Let's try and debunk that a little bit. I don't know if you want to start
with that. Well, a bit like the other explanations, it doesn't make sense of the facts. It's possible that one person, so if only one person out of the whole sort of group of people who could have done it, said, you know, if there's only Mary Magdalene or there's only Peter or John or someone who said, I've seen the risen Christ, that was the only one. And then the whole of Christianity is built on this one testimony. Then it's reasonable to say, well, just maybe it was a vision and not the real thing. But because so many people saw it, the idea of a collective visionary experience is just not at all credible.
It's never happened.
No. No, it's not
500. I mean, 1 Corinthians 15 tells us that over 500 had seen the risen Christ. So for 500 people to all have the same hallucination, vision, probably not the case.
And just straight facts, it's never happened. There's no record of that in the psychological case files. That's not happened.
So. No. And what's really compelling is that you always get outriders for stuff like that. So even if you got, you know, by some kind of, I don't know, groupthink, you got a few people to believe something. Obviously, controlling 500 is almost impossible, but you'd get outriders who don't think the same and who are debunking it. The thing is, in both the Bible itself, but also in secular literature around, there's no effort made because there's no one who's actually saying, no, it didn't happen. That's a really fascinating thing. There's not loads of writing. The only sort of contrary argument is made by those who said at the time, the Jewish and Roman leaders, about just pretend that the disciples stole the body. Mm. You know, they got paid money for that, the Jewish temple guard. But then that's understood. But apart from that, there's no other explanations that are zimming around. Mm. Interestingly, as the disciples start speaking, there's no counter explanations that are coming back from the people.
That's right.
They just want to get rid of them, but they don't say, oh no, that, you know, this happened, we know this.
Yeah, the body's here.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So I don't think the group hallucination works.
No. So we don't hold, hallucination theory doesn't hold much water.
No.
So we're left with the three facts. The death, the burial, the empty tomb, and the disciples' sudden and sincere belief, despite their presuppositions, which would have been to the contrary. They weren't expecting a risen Messiah. They weren't expecting a dying Messiah. So we've discussed these few alternate theories. Apparent death doesn't work. And even if it did, it only explains one of the things, which is the empty tomb, really. Doesn't explain why the disciples believed. Stolen body, again, doesn't really work and doesn't have good scope. It doesn't explain why the disciples came to believe, because they would have stolen it themselves. Or the Jews, if they had stolen it, would have presented the body. Mm. And the hallucination theory doesn't explain enough. It doesn't explain the fact that many people claim to see the risen Christ. So there's not much explanatory power in these alternate theories. And so what are we left with?
Well, I think we're left with Jesus risen from the dead. I think just to expand the sincere change of heart from the disciples is that, having been persuaded, they went out and spoke to people about it in very convincing ways. And it talks about giving convincing proofs by their kind of eyewitness accounts. And actually, the existence of the church is a kind of follow-on from that. So although we're not listening to their explanations, we have written down their explanations. But also, just the fact that the church started is only really explained by the resurrection. You can see, say, the existence of Islam. You can look at it from a sort of sociological, political perspective, and you can say, I can understand how Islam arose. Mm-hmm. In these set of circumstances, the idolatry that was around in the Persian Gulf, the Middle East then, and the Jewish explanations, the Christian explanations that were around, you can see how the soup of all that created this person Muhammad with his experiences and the military might and all that. So you can say, here's an explanation for this world religion, Islam.
Yeah.
What you can't do is explain Christianity without the resurrection.
Yeah.
It would have just disappeared within Judaism as just a sort of, you know, one of these things that burns for a little while and then dies out.
Yeah.
But not the world changing religion that it became.
Yeah. So, any final thoughts from Mark?
Well,
I believe that he's... We convinced
believe.
Mark,
yeah,
anyway.
I believe. I want to start singing. In the resurrection. No, we won't go.
Oh, you wanted to sing that
yeah,
so much.
Yeah, all day. It's all fun. I think, though, if we're honest, there is still a question that we probably will need to address in another podcast, because all of this is based on, actually, the historical record of the scriptures. Mm-hmm. So you then got to be able to defend the scriptures and say, how do we know this? The Bible is true? For all those other theories to, I mean, so we can
I think we can do that in another podcast sometime.
Well, no, I think we're going to have to. I think we're going to have to think about, okay, how do we know the Bible's true? You know,
We're going to do that one. But it'd be really good to do with the resurrection to encourage people to think, I could say these things.
Amen.
And more than that, I want to try and get across to my friend, my family member, that if that's true, it certainly makes Christianity worth looking into.
Yes.
So it's not just, I've proved to them that Jesus rose from the dead, so what? Lots of interesting things happen in history and I don't care about most of them. This is the so what is, everything he said about himself, about God, about us, is all true. So we need to take notice of it. So to finding ways of encouraging people to not just have the facts, but have the significance of the facts as well, that it changes everything.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Ordinary. As always, if you have questions about this or any of the episodes you've listened to, email them to ordinary at cchh.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. As ever, subscribe to the podcast, share it with your friends, and make sure you come back next week for a brand new episode of Ordinary.